From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Anthony Brooks, and this is On Point. Making news this week, a new model projects 300,000 American deaths from COVID-19 by the end of 2020. While President Trump defended his management of the crisis, including his view on testing.
You know, there are those that say, you can test too much. You do know that.
Who says that?
Oh, just read the manuals, read the books.
Manuals?
Read the books.
What manuals?
Read the books.
What books?
In Congress, the battle over a new economic relief package continued without resolution. Here's Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer.
We believe the patient needs a major operation while Republicans want to apply just a Band-Aid. We won't let them just pass the Band-Aid, go home, and leave America bleeding.
And more wins for progressive Democrats in primary races across the country. In Missouri, activist Cori Bush ousted longtime incumbent Congressman William Lacey Clay.
We have to have people who are supporting and advocating for the regular, everyday person. And now that doesn't mean we just need to switch out everybody in Congress, because that's not what it's about. What it's about is where there is failed leadership.
Lots of news this week, lots to dig into, and we have a great panel to help us do that. With us from Washington is Margaret Taleff, politics and White House editor at Axios. Margaret, great to have you back. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Anthony.
And Sungmin Kim, White House reporter for The Washington Post, who focuses on the intersection of the Trump administration and Capitol Hill. She's with us as well. Sung, good to have you.
Thanks for having me.
So let's begin with Jonathan Swan's interview with President Trump on Axios. It was a 40-minute interview or so at the White House. Swan was incredibly well-prepared, sparred with the president about the pandemic, Russian intelligence, mail-in voting, Black Lives Matter, among other subjects. So I want to start right off with a little bit of a clip. So here's an exchange from that interview about different metrics regarding the pandemic and the death rate.
Take a look at some of these charts.
I'd love to.
We're going to look.
Let's look.
And if you look at death,
yeah, started to go up again.
One. Well, right here, the United States is lowest in numerous categories. We're lower than the world.
Lower than
we're
the
lower
world.
Than
what does that
Europe.
Mean? In what?
Look.
In what?
Take a look. Right here. Here's case death.
Oh, you're doing death as a proportion of cases. I'm talking about death as a proportion of population. That's where the U.S. is really bad.
So that's Jonathan Swan interviewing President Trump this week. Margaret Taleff, I want to start with you, Jonathan Swan, a colleague of yours at Axios. What did you hear in that interview this week?
It's a remarkable interview. And as you can imagine, it's a pleasure to edit Jonathan Swan. But if I would really encourage any listeners who haven't watched the whole interview to go back and watch it, because if you listen to that clip, you hear this kind of hint of incredulosity in his voice. But if you watch it from the beginning, you'll see that it's kind of a place that he ramped up to as the president would kind of continuously try to redirect, remaneuver the conversation to fit the narrative that he wanted to pursue. What you're hearing in this moment is the president trying to find a kind of a winning narrative or a narrative of success inside a statistical thread that really shows something quite different. And you see the president come armed with charts, prepared with colored graphs showing different levels in different places, but it doesn't address the question that's actually important to a person who gets sick in this country or who has lost a loved one in this country. And, part of this is that the president is provided with statistics to kind of help him stay upbeat, because his team understands that that he'll feel very frustrated if he doesn't feel like he's winning. But part of this is the president's just has been consistently unwilling to look at the statistics as a whole and own them and say the U.S. has got to do better. And you hear Fauci say it, you hear lawmakers say it, you hear basically every governor and mayor and public health official in the country saying it. But the president is just so focused on trying to find an argument to show why the U.S. is doing better than other countries that in this interview, I think you see him really unwilling to just face the numbers as they exist.
Face the numbers that, as they exist, and offer some numbers of his own. I mean, for instance, he makes the statement in the course of this interview that he's responsible for saving millions of lives. I mean, at one point he says that. Sung Min, what did you hear in this interview? Was it as striking to you as it was to Margaret?
It was definitely as striking to me. I thought it was a terrific interview, and it really showed the value of just following up. We know the president talks a lot to the media, and talks in and shares, you know, questionable, or shares claims that are questionable in fact. And I thought what that interview showed was just the value of following up and just asking him to prove his claims, because a lot of times there is not that data, there's not that fact to back up what the president is saying. It's particularly on the coronavirus. One passage that was remarkable to me was when the president insisted that there are people who insist that there is too much testing. I have not heard of a single person who says the United States could be doing too many coronavirus tests. And Jonathan just kind of followed up and said, who is saying that? And the president didn't answer and just kind of tried to pivot and move on. And I thought that was really illuminating. Margaret is completely right that the president and his team have really tried to put a rosy outlook on their handling of the pandemic. And there is a certain kind of, cheerleader mode that the president of the United States has to do at a time. But the president has continually, you know, struggled to grapple with at least in his public comments, grapple with the reality and the severity of this pandemic. And I thought this interview really showed that in an excellent way.
Go ahead, Margaret.
Offer like an insight. This is kind of like for news nerds or inside the room, but one of the values I think of this interview is that it helps, maybe helps people see the experience of what it's like to try to ask questions of the president. And in larger formats, like a news conference or a gaggle out before he takes off on a flight or something, it's very hard to kind of follow through because a lot of people are shouting questions at the same time, and the president's very adept at redirecting. And a lot of times in a print interview, a print interview is harder to express the dynamic. You can write a story about the answers or the not answers, but it's the nonverbal cues, the redirects, and just the kind of experience of that unfolded there. I think is that obviously was not the intention of the interview, was to get answers to questions, but an interview on camera like this. And the same is true for Chris Wallace's earlier. It does show some of these dynamics of the way the president operates. I had a friend who sent me an email. Dictionary.com has like a word of the day. And their offering for Friday, August the 7th is axiomatic. And I think she thought of it because it sounds like axios. They said axiomatic. It's an adjective that means self-evident or obvious. What I like about the interview is that it really gives you kind of a pure stream of consciousness of the experience of trying to press the president on questions like this and hold him accountable and connect the dots.
It really does, Margaret. And I liked your suggestion that for listeners, our listeners who haven't actually looked at that interview online, it's a great recommendation. Do it, because it's interesting on so many levels. It's fascinating to see the president put in that spot and answer the questions. And, you know, for journalism nerds, I think watching Jonathan Swan, I mean, it's a case study in how you sort of remain calm, insistent, push back, courteous, but just hold on to the facts and keep insisting that the president answer the question. It was really something. I want to play another moment from it. So this is about reports that Russia offered the Taliban bounties on American soldiers. The Times broke this story in June. The president spoke to Putin, Russian President Putin, on July 23rd. Here's how he reacted when Jonathan Swan asked him about it.
It never reached my desk. You know why? Because they didn't think it was intelligence. They didn't think it was real.
It was in your written brief, though.
They didn't think it was worthy of it. I wouldn't mind. If it reached my desk, I would have done something about it. It never reached my desk because...
Do you read your written brief?
I do.
Do you?
I read a lot.
Really?
You know, I read a lot. They like to say I don't read. I read a lot.
Your daily intelligence brief?
I comprehend extraordinarily well, probably better than anybody that you've interviewed in a long time.
So I want to ask you both about this. What's the calculus here by the White House? Because I think you, Margaret, mentioned the interview with Chris Wallace. Now he's doing Jonathan Swan. These are two interviews where I have to say the president seemed outmatched by the people interviewing him. The White House is full of smart people who know what the president is gonna get when he sits down with an interview like this. Why did they do it? Why did they agree to it? You first, Margaret.
I think these are, in the case of the Chris Wallace interview, an interview on a network where the president feels comfortable. I know he's sometimes critical of Fox now, more than he used to be, but not compared with, you know, other networks. And I think in our case, you know, we're a news organization that he feels has treated him fairly. It's a reporter who President Trump feels he could get a fair hearing from. And so the White House has been frustrated that they don't like the narrative arc of the coverage. And the president has wanted to get out there and attach his narrative to talking about everything from, I think, the coronavirus to Joe Biden and the presidential election. The problem is that when you really come prepared factually, some of these questions are difficult to address with talking points. You have to have kind of an honest conversation about it. And when it comes to this issue with Russia and the bounties and the intelligence about it, the president seemed to be touching on the idea that, there were questions about the intelligence or that sort of thing. But to compare it with the Soviet involvement in Afghanistan decades ago just didn't make a lot of sense.
Right. I'm struck by the idea about why this isn't a bigger scandal than it seems to be. I mean, the idea that an intelligence report of such consequence didn't make it to the president's desk, or if it did, he didn't read it, or if he did read it, now is he lying about it? I mean, any of the above is pretty shocking. Anyway, we're going to move on. We're going to talk a little bit more about the Jonathan Swan interview after the break. We're talking about the week in review. Stay with us. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This episode is brought to you by ShipStation. If you run an e-commerce business, you know how much work it takes to produce something great while dealing with complicated shipping issues. That's why over 130,000 companies have turned to ShipStation, an innovative tool that allows you to focus less on shipping and more on building your brand. With ShipStation, you can manage orders, label printing, reporting, and customer service on one easy-to-use dashboard. You'll reduce warehouse costs with reliable enterprise solutions and save thousands on shipping costs with discounts up to 89% off. Plus, you can effortlessly import orders from everywhere you sell online. So, turn your shipping challenges into opportunities for growth. Go to ShipStation.com and use code POD to sign up for your free 60-day trial. That's ShipStation.com. Code POD.
This is On Point. I'm Anthony Brooks. We're talking about the news of the week, including President Trump's interview with Jonathan Swan of Axios. Here's another moment from that interview when Swan asked the president about the national conversation about systematic racism, particularly against Black Americans.
I did more for the Black community than anybody, with the possible exception of Abraham Lincoln, whether you like it or not. People say, oh, that's
you really you believe you did more than Lyndon Johnson, who passed the Civil Rights Act?
I think I did, yeah.
How?
Because I got criminal justice reform done. I got prison reform.
Lyndon Johnson. He passed the Civil Rights Act.
How has it worked out? If you take a look at what Lyndon Johnson did.
You think the Civil Rights Act was a mistake?
How has it worked out?
President Trump there with Jonathan Swan of Axios. I'm here with Margaret Talib from Axios, Sungmin Kim of The Washington Post. And joining us from Detroit is Kat Stafford. She's national race and ethnicity writer for the Associated Press. And Kat, great to have you back on Point. Thanks for joining us.
Yes, thanks, Anthony.
I'd love to get your response to this Axios interview and you know, start with what we just heard, the president's response to Jonathan Swan about racism in America.
Yes, I think what this interview really shows is a continued pattern in regards to President Trump not fully confronting the racial history of this country, right? It's the very thing that a lot of Black activists and really other folks have really been taking the president to task over since he became president of this country. So it's not entirely surprising to hear the president say this. These are remarks that he's been making for quite a long while.
I was struck in terms of some of the questions around race when Jonathan Swan asked him to think about John Lewis's legacy. All the president could say, I don't know much about John Lewis because he didn't come to my inauguration.
Yes, and to hear the president say that about John Lewis, a man who literally dedicated his entire life to the civil rights fight, for the struggle for not just Black Americans, but for everyone in this country, to hear the president kind of rebuff the legacy of John Lewis, it frankly upset a lot of people. A lot of people want to hear the president of this country in this moment really have an honest discussion about racism, the fact that it is deeply embedded within the fabric of this nation. So to hear him say that, it's once again, you know, seeing the president not fully confront and reckon with the moment that we are currently in.
Hmm. Well, Margaret, Sungmin, and Kat, let's move on. I want to talk about efforts to fashion a new stimulus bill. And there's an impasse between Democrats and the White House on a new stimulus plan. The two sides remain far apart. So let's listen to a little bit of tape here. Here's House Speaker Nancy Pelosi. She appeared on PBS NewsHour on Tuesday. She said she was committed to ensuring unemployed Americans get that $600 in federal benefits a week.
We're far apart in terms of our values, quite frankly. We're far apart in understanding the gravity of the situation. Are we determined to find an agreement? Yes. We will find our common ground, but we won't find it on the slim reed of a piecemeal bill that says to our workers, you used to get 600, you're now going to get 200 because the virus has intensified in its spread.
And the day after that, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell accused Democrats of blocking the relief package with their unwillingness to compromise. Here he is on the Senate floor.
While Americans are struggling, the Democratic leaders have moved about one inch in 8 days. For the sake of the millions and millions who need more help, let's hope they decide to get serious soon.
Kat, let me come to you first on this. What do you hear in this debate, in this impasse? What's your take?
Well, what I hear is Congress, you know, not fully listening to what Americans are seeing in this moment. Americans are crying out for help from their leaders. We are talking about a country that is really facing what I like to call three crises at once. We're dealing with the health fallout, you know, African Americans and other people of color dying at disparate rates from COVID-19. We're also dealing with the economic fallout, which is what this discussion is really about, the fact that more people need money to just sustain their lives. But we're also dealing with this racial reckoning, right? And so right now, I think Americans are saying, hey, we've been out of work for so long. How can we function? How can we continue? So people really want to see Congress come to a resolution on this because there are still so many communities across this country right now where people are really out of work and they're struggling. Rent is due. What's the answer?
Yeah, rent is due. And there are reports of lots of people facing eviction not far down the road as well. Sungmin, I'd like to come to you on this. What is the blockage? Well, let me ask you this. I mean, the last report that I read very quickly before we went to air was it seems like these talks are close to breaking down altogether. What's the latest? What do we know?
I mean, right now they look like they really are on the teetering of collapse. I mean, we always say in these tough congressional and administration negotiations, there is always kind of the bad meeting before there comes a deal. Both sides kind of have to let out their anger, let out their positions. There's always kind of like that tense meeting. But on Capitol Hill for the last 2 weeks, it's been a series of those bad meetings, and there just doesn't seem to be any public progress. They are, you know, even just speaking numbers, they are trillions of dollars apart. You know, the starting proposal for Senate Republicans was about $1 trillion, which a plan that the administration had mostly endorsed. Democrats are sticking to a $3.4 trillion plan that passed the Democratic-controlled House back in May. And it's remarkable just how, we are in the middle of this economic and public health crisis. We are actually past certain deadlines, and there doesn't seem to be an actual willingness for a compromise, at least that we're publicly seeing. And right now, what we're seeing more is political positioning and posturing, so you can blame each other when the fallout comes. I think Democrats believe they have the upper hand here because they were at least able to pass through one of the chambers of Congress a proposal, and that Republicans are severely divided on theirs, and that's why House Speaker Nancy Pelosi and Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer have been unwilling to compromise as much as Republicans would like. But Republicans are increasingly, getting really serious about their unwillingness to kind of move off their proposal that, I would emphasize, would never pass the Republican-controlled Senate nor be signed into law by the president. Now, President Trump is threatening executive orders to deal with at least some parts of what would have been done legislatively. And I would point out that there are legality questions as to whether he could do that.
Yeah, Sungmin, hold up just a second, because I wanted to read part of that tweet, which I believe came yesterday. So before he departed for Ohio, he tweeted, I've notified my staff to continue working on an executive order with respect to payroll tax cut, eviction protections, unemployment extensions, and student loan repayment options. Sounds hopeful, Margaret. Is it? I mean, can the president do this sort of thing by executive order? How would that work?
Yeah, we haven't seen the language yet, although our understanding is that it has been drafted and that these are multiple executive orders, not one. But Nancy Pelosi has signaled publicly that she doesn't think that he can. And even if he can, I mean, the president can't appropriate money. He can just redirect money that exists within his jurisdiction, within his purview.
Right. There's this whole thing about Congress holding the purse strings, kind of important.
That whole thing about separation of powers, right? And so would Pelosi do something to challenge it? What would her recourse be? Or would it just be a matter of the president not really having enough money to actually do what he's suggesting he's going to do, what the White House could do, what the president could do? And I think this will certainly be a part of the strategy, is give states more flexibility to spend money. But that's money the states were counting on to do other things with. So if you push the blame onto states, then, well, we gave the states the power to do it. I don't know. You know, I think this is, we could be looking at sort of a lot of politics and not that much substance until Congress actually acts, because you still need Congress if you're going to do real money. This stuff costs real money. And here are the latest jobs numbers, right? The economy gaining 1.8 million jobs. Okay, that's better than no jobs, but that does not signal the kind of robust economic recovery, or even like economic recovery that the president wants heading into the core of the election season. And this totally affects individuals, especially people who are out of work, right? Or who are small business people, but it also affects the economy. And if consumer spending takes a dip as a result of less money going into spending, it could have massive implications nationwide and even globally. And that is the bet, that is the wager that that the Republicans are taking ultimately, because they are the ones who where the president is the incumbent, and he's where the buck stops on the economy.
Mm. Yeah, that new jobs report you mentioned, 1.8 million new jobs in July. That report, I mean, it's funny. You can read it in sort of two ways. It's like, wow, it's almost 2 million jobs. On the other hand, it contains evidence that the hiring is actually slowing down. And of course, the unemployment rate is still over 10%. So big challenges there. We need to move on because there's lots of other stuff to talk about. And I want to talk about some of the election primaries we saw this week in several states. So let's talk about Missouri, where Cori Bush, a single mother, a pastor, a leader in the growing protest movement, ousted longtime Congressman William Lacey Clay. And this was really the latest jolt to the Democratic establishment by progressives. So here she is discussing the potential significance of her win.
I believe when people see someone like me, someone who is just a regular everyday person, an essential worker, working class nurse, you know, single parent, someone who's been unhoused, been uninsured, been a low wage worker, a survivor of sexual assault and domestic violence. When people see that, you know, it speaks to them. And it's also signaling. So it's not just signaling to the community, hey, we need a regular everyday person in Congress, but it's signaling to other people saying, hey, I can do this too. I can run.
That's Cori Bush on our program yesterday. Kat Stafford, I'd love to talk to you about this race. What do you think? What's the significance of it? It was quite something because William Lacey Clay. People have been voting for Clay in that district for a long, long time because, of course, his father had the seat before him.
Yes. So this is a legacy. This is a role that's been filled by his family for quite a long time, like you said. But what this signals is it's two different things. And it's historic, really, on two different fronts. Cori Bush will be the first Black woman to ever represent that community, namely St. Louis in Congress. And that alone is significant. But it's also kind of concerning that in 2020 that this is just now happening, right? But the other piece of this is it's also historic because Cori is known in that community for her on the ground work, on the ground activism, and her deep community roots. I mean, she really, came on the scene for her work in Ferguson after the fatal shooting of Michael Brown, right? So what this really is a sign is that, once again, communities across the nation are pushing for change. They're saying that they want leaders who are not just progressive thinkers, but who are actually on the ground in their neighborhoods, talking to them and taking what they say and putting that into tangible action. So for me, when I saw that, she's going to likely win the seat, it really represents a sea of change.
Hmm. Yeah. Her win, Cori Bush's win, follows the likes of Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez of New York, Ayanna Pressley of Massachusetts, among others, who knocked off long-serving Democrats. And let me come to you, Sungmin, about this. I mean, I'm curious what you think. You know, they're part of this generational and political split within the Democratic Party. We talked about this a bunch yesterday. But what do you see as the significance of sort of progressive Democrats flexing their muscles in this way, particularly in an election year?
Well, I think that it's just it shows just so much of that progressive energy that is really rising within the House Democratic Caucus. And you are not just knocking out people who have been there for a short amount of time. I think the loss of Elliot Engel, who is a chairman of a very powerful committee, was a very significant win for the progressive movement. And I think we're all kind of watching the next if we're talking about trends here. We are watching the upcoming election of Congressman Richie Neal in Massachusetts, who is himself facing a primary challenger, who has gotten criticism under the Trump administration for not being, perhaps not as aggressive in standing up to President Trump as he could have been, particularly on his tax returns, which is his jurisdiction as the chairman of the powerful House Ways and Means Committee. So that's definitely a race that we're watching. Another dynamic I do want to point out, too, is if, Joe Biden does win the presidency, who, by most measures is not considered progressive in the types of these candidates that we're talking about, how does this rising insurgent left in the House Democratic Caucus work with a significantly more moderate Democratic president? And what are those tensions? And how does that affect policy being made on Capitol Hill?
It's a great question, Sungmin. And one thing I wanted to sort of throw in there, you mentioned Richard Neal, Congressman Richard Neal of Massachusetts, being challenged. He's being challenged by Holyoke Mayor Alex Morse. So that is indeed an interesting race to watch. Margaret Talov, though, pick up on Sungmin's point about what this might portend for a Joe Biden should he win the presidency? Because one of the things we heard yesterday was not a lot of enthusiasm from these new progressive voices for Joe Biden, but a commitment to work hard to get Donald Trump out of office. But then the point, if Joe Biden makes it to the White House, he's going to hear from us if he doesn't respond to the issues that we think are so important.
Right. Well, I mean, I think, look, in the short term, Joe Biden has to look at this as an upside and an opportunity because, yes, in a primary election, this would make things difficult for Joe Biden, but Joe Biden survived the primary process. In a general election, if these are voters who can be motivated to turn out and in some cases, some of these voters may not have turned out in 2016, that could be enough in key states to help push Joe Biden over the edge, right? But then, of course, be careful what you wish for, because then if you win, you have to govern. And it's you can't dispute the notion that there is not just a progressive, because what does progressive mean anyway, an activist movement in the Democratic Party that is rising up and taking their seat at the table, and is an activist movement that is racially diverse, ethnically diverse, and has a lot more women in it. And whoever the next president is going to have a hell of a lot of challenges on the economic and social front to contend with. And this new movement pushing them to the left.
We are talking about a big week in the news, about the pandemic, about primary politics. Coming up, we're going to be talking a little about the presidential election, conventions, among other issues as well. We're talking about the week in the news. I'm Anthony Brooks. We'll be right back. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Anthony Brooks. Next week on the program, we're going to devote an hour to talking about love during the pandemic. Listeners, we want to hear your stories. How has the lockdown changed your most important relationship? Or how has it felt to be single during all of this? We want to hear about your best physical distance dates and your worst. Tell us your story at 617-353-0683. Again, that's 617-353-0683. And join the program next week. This hour, we have a great panel to guide us through the week in the news. I'm here with Margaret Talov, politics and White House editor at Axios. Sungmin Kim, the White House reporter for The Washington Post, who focuses on the intersection of the Trump administration and Capitol Hill. And Kat Stafford, national race and ethnicity writer for the Associated Press, is with us as well. I want to talk a little bit about some presidential election news. First, we expect any day now to hear from Joe Biden about his running mate. Lots of speculation around a number of African-American women in particular, including Kamala Harris of California, Susan Rice, the former UN ambassador, Karen Bass, the congresswoman. We had an indication that this would be coming this week. It hasn't. Kat Stafford, what do you know or thinking about in terms of the timing of this announcement, or what you expect or hope to hear from Joe Biden?
Yes. So right now, everyone is expecting that an announcement could be made next week. But again, as you just noted, this is changing every day. But I do want to point out that in this moment, I think it's important to specifically pay attention to the Black electorate right now, with the emphasis on Black women and what they are really hoping to see come of this announcement. We had a story that we wrote earlier this month that really dove into the history of Black women in politics. And in this moment, what they desire, what they're demanding to see. And what struck me about this moment is a lot of Black women are saying, if not now, when? When will we see a return on an investment that we have long made in this Democratic Party with our support, by ushering our family and friends to the polls and really making sure that we support these candidates? When will we see something in return? And for a lot of women, what that means in this moment is they are hoping that Joe Biden will pick a Black woman to be his vice president. Not just any Black woman, but a Black woman who has the ability to empathize and really understand a lot of these longstanding and systemic issues that have plagued Black Americans for so long. So I think in this moment, this pick is going to be crucial for him, because once again, we're in the middle of this racial reckoning, right? So he needs someone who could be his partner and stand by his side and really help push the country toward the right direction should he be elected.
Mm. Margaret, I'd love to hear from you on this, both on this issue of timing, when we might hear from Joe Biden, and what you sort of hear in this delay. Well, I don't know if we call it a delay, but there has been an expectation that it could come any day now. And also respond to Kat's point about it seems like this would be a difficult thing for Joe Biden to go against with so many qualified African-American women apparently on his short list.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, every source that my reporters and I talk to who's around or close to or inside the Biden world acknowledges that with both the coronavirus's disparate impacts on people of color and with the killing of George Floyd and the aftermath that followed, the national demonstrations, the call for change, that it really changed the dynamic, the calculus in terms of it being important not just to have a woman, but a woman of color on that ticket. And so you saw there were many people who thought Elizabeth Warren would be a good running mate, including many African-Americans who said Elizabeth Warren has the most in-depth policy proposals to deal with minorities and disparities in economic disparities and health disparities and so on and so forth. Many people who think that Gretchen Whitmer could make sense as a running mate for him, who say that calculus has changed now. So our reporting tells us that the two top choices are Kamala Harris and Susan Rice, and for very different reasons. Both are accomplished Black women who have served in government, but Kamala Harris has served in elected office and has a higher national profile. Susan Rice has not served in elective office, and while is very well known among people who follow policy closely, is not as much of a household name with the average voter. But Karen Bass also has been seriously considered, but there is a feeling that her chances have diminished in the wake of revelations about some of her past support of not just support, but rhetoric around Cuba and around Scientology, right. And the notion that, you know, like a House member.
And
is
Margaret,
not a
sorry to interrupt. I just want to sort of, for listeners who are catching up with us, Karen Bass, of course, Congresswoman from California, Black caucus leader in Congress, and extremely well regarded by the liberal wing of the Democratic Party. But go on, I didn't mean to interrupt.
Yeah, that's right. No, but you know, like, there's always a danger in this speculation. We could all be completely wrong, and it could be somebody else. But consistently, what we're hearing inside our reporting is that Harris and Rice present kind of the two choices that both Biden and his inner circle are most focused around. We know that he has a friendship, a genuine friendship, and a close working relationship with Rice from her time inside the Obama administration, and even dating back to the campaign, like 2007, 2008, right? But that we know with Harris, even though there are some
some bristling and some not perfect feelings because of their clashes over, you know, busing or racial, you know, racial sensitivities, Biden's ability to talk about race issues in a modern way, all that stuff that played out on the primary, that for the most part, there's a sense that that's something that both of them could get past. And that one of the most appealing things about Harris in Biden world is the idea that the Trump campaign just hasn't figured out a way to go after her. I mean, they just, maybe they have one, but if they haven't shown what it is. And internally from Trump world, we hear that that is the one that they are sort of the most puzzled about how to run against.
Really interesting. Well, decision coming soon. I want to move on to another topic. Sung-min, I'll come to you on this. I mean, it appears the Democratic National Convention is pretty much dead. This week, Joe Biden said he'd deliver his acceptance speech from Delaware rather than Milwaukee, which was supposed to host the DNC. Reporters are told to stay away. I guess there'll be some primetime programming, but the question I have is this still a convention if nobody's convening? I mean, what do you think?
It really does sort of take the, you know, the excitement, the energy out of a convention. I mean, a lot of these conventions are pretty pro forma. You know, you have the speeches from various high-ranking elected officials, rising stars in the party. It is certainly a platform for, say, like a Barack Obama to make his national kind of splash. And it certainly is a venue for that. But obviously, with the pandemic, the fear they aren't allowed. You don't have kind of the similar, you know, pizzazz that a convention would do. I mean, I think both parties are grappling with the realities of that, and it certainly won't be the same this year. In terms of having that excitement for either, you know, the Democratic Party or the Republican Party, I think the big question now is what is President Trump going to do with his formal acceptance speech? He has kind of toyed with several locations, most notably the White House, which has actually prompted some pushback from Republicans saying that perhaps optically it may not be a good idea to give such a blatant political speech from taxpayer-funded grounds. Some Republican senators have even questioned whether that is legal. And we know how much the White House and the Republican National Committee had pushed to make this a more normal convention, you know, even moving the big part of the convention from Charlotte to Jacksonville, which and then obviously had to cancel the Jacksonville portion of the RNC once the White House kind of really realized just the public health dangers there.
So now it's back in Charlotte, right? Yeah. It was Charlotte, Jacksonville, now it's back in Charlotte with a possible speech from the South Lawn of the White House. Okay, this is
correct.
Right.
A lot of the business stuff, businessy, kind of not as fun part of the conventions were going to remain in Charlotte, but that big kind of balloon dropping from the ceiling, everybody cheering, dressed in red, white, and blue, that part had been in Jacksonville until it was called off by the president a few weeks ago.
Right. Margaret, I've been hearing you sort of exhaling about this idea of...
No.
In a good way. I meant that in a good way. It makes me want to know what you're thinking.
It's just like you've seen the president really ramp up the giving of blatantly political speeches, like from the Rose Garden. And, you know, some of us old schoolers kind of had palpitations about that. But the notion of formally accepting the nomination from the White House takes it to a whole new level of just like talk about norm busting. So I think, you know, two things. I think number one, we're going to see a greatly sort of condensed and dialed back convention on both sides, no matter what the president decides to do venue-wise. I think he now understands it cannot be the spectacle that he once hoped that it would be. And what that means is that we're going to see a much sort of expedited look ahead to the debates as having much more importance than they might have otherwise, because the conventions cannot. For reporters, whether you love or hate conventions, conventions are a great way to, you know, do some of your best sourcing, catch all these people in a room. But for candidates, it is free airtime on prime time. And I think because the scheduling is dialed back now, there's just going to be less primetime network coverage. There's going to be less to cover. And the American public's attention is going to be less focused on it than normal, even if there's a spectacle at the White House, even if, you know, high profile names in both parties, including the nominees, are talking. It's just as a kind of galvanizing event that captures the public's attention. I just think all signs are that it's going to be less.
Kat Stafford, what do you make of sort of what appears to be, for the moment at least, the end of political conventions as we've known them, and how and the effect that that might have, could have, on the presidential election as we move toward November?
I agree with everything that's been said thus far. But what I would also add is that what this really shows is how far we truly have to go to really be at the end of this pandemic. And for me, that's the most stunning part about all of this, is we have no idea of what the end in sight looks like or when that will actually be. And when you think about that in the context of the election, when you think about the fact that just this past Tuesday on the primary, just using Detroit, where I'm based as an example, there were a lot of issues at different polls, people being turned away, told to go elsewhere. So for a lot of people that are seeing issues like that popping up for a primary, looking toward November, when we don't know where we will be in this pandemic, there's a lot of concern about what will the November election look like. So that's what I'm thinking about moving forward, especially in my coverage, is paying attention to especially these communities of color, where we have long had a lot of issues at the polls and as they're counting these ballots.
Really important issue, because it's going to be a very different kind of election because of this pandemic. I want to quickly touch on one story. Facebook and Twitter took action to take down essentially videos posted by President Trump as misinformation. So this week, Trump basically put on Twitter, the Trump campaign basically put on Twitter a statement by the president in a Fox interview suggesting that children are almost immune from COVID-19. Facebook took it down. Margaret, very quickly to you on this. It's interesting, particularly because Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg has said he doesn't want to be in the business of policing speech. It seems like they made a step in that direction. What do you think?
Yeah, he may not want to be, but guess what? Every social media chief is finding out with power comes responsibility. And there's a growing consumer expectation as well as inside of Congress. And it's only going to heighten if the Democrats galvanize their power on this. And look, we're looking ahead to a very uncertain period of time where there could be foreign interference in the upcoming election. There could be misinformation propagated on social media, and the results of many elections, including the presidential, could potentially be contested because of issues over mail-in balloting and absentee balloting. If you are a social media executive and you have the power to galvanize opinion and swing votes, essentially, not directly, but as a pass-through, the responsibility, and if there is blame, is going to fall on you to some extent. And these companies are having a reckoning. They need to learn from the lessons of 2016 and apply them in a forward, future-looking way. And we're beginning to see that, I think.
Panelists, you've been great, and we only have a short time left, and it goes without saying that these have been tough times for lots of people, and doing a show like this means that we inevitably dwell on a lot of bad news. So in the last minute or two, I want to ask at least one of you, depending on how much time we have, for a bit of good news that you're thinking about, or something hopeful or aspirational that can send us off into the weekend with something to smile about. So here's my thought. It begins with grim news of the moment. Earlier this week, we did a show looking at the surging pandemic across the country and around the world. And at the end of the program, I asked Harvard epidemiologist Bill Hanage to give us something to feel hopeful about in this moment. And here's what he said.
The sense of community, the sense of outpouring of people eager to help, that's something which makes me feel sort of inspired. I mean, we are living through historic times, and our grandchildren are going to be asking us what this was like when they write school projects about it. And when people ask me what was the thing that gave you hope, I would just say people.
Just people. That's Bill Hanage, professor of epidemiology at Harvard's T.H. Chan School of Public Health. Sungmin, we only have about 10 or 15 seconds left. I'm going to put you on the spot and ask us for something hopeful as we go off into this weekend.
I think I would go along with what was just said. I think that in crisis, you do see so much of the community come together, even if our elected officials may struggle at times. You see so much of the community pitching. I've just seen it in my neighborhood, and I'm sure others as well, you know, collect food, diapers, essentials for our neighbors who are struggling to make ends meet right now for economic reasons, and just really give of themselves. And that's just been really hopeful and inspiring to see.
All right. Sungmin Kim, White House reporter for The Washington Post. Thank you so much for joining us today. We really appreciate it. Have a great weekend. And Margaret Taloff, politics and White House editor at Axios. Always great to have you. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
And Kat Stafford, national race and ethnicity writer for the Associated Press. Kat, have a great weekend. Thanks for being with us today.
Thanks. You too.
That's it for today. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is On Point.